Good morning, everyone. We are now calling court file A24-0568 in the matter of the civil commitment of Alake Fale. I'm Judge Jepal Harris, and with me today are Judges Edward Cleary and Judge Diane Bradfold. Before we get started, just a couple of preliminary matters. This matter is being recorded. With that being said, I will ask the attorneys when you do begin your argument to please fully state your name. In addition, we are appearing via Zoom, so I will just note to all the parties in the courtroom that we are still governed by the same rules of decorum. I would ask that this matter not be recorded by anyone, and I will ask that the attorneys have their video on when they are arguing. This matter is being recorded, and it will be released on the court's website shortly after today's hearing. With that, each party will have 15 minutes for oral argument, with the appellant having an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. With that, I will turn to the appellant, and you can start your argument when you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is Rosalind Sullivan, and I represent the appellant Alake Fale. The issues on appeal today are whether the evidence was sufficient to support a finding of dangerousness and whether the facts support, I'm sorry, whether the facts presented establish that a less restrictive state-operated treatment program or treatment facilities as available that is consistent with the patient's treatment needs and the requirements of public safety. And whether procedural errors led to an improper application of the standard for dangerousness. It is Mr. Fale's position that the lower court erred in its determination of finding him to be mentally ill and dangerous. Mr. Fale does not deny having a history of mental illness, nor having a mental illness, nor does he deny having a history of drug use. In fact, his mental illness is what brought about his drug use. Mr. Fale's concerns today regarding the lower court's decision is that the court did not look at the totality of circumstances in this case when determining him to be mentally ill and dangerous. Mr. Fale does not believe that there was sufficient evidence of dangerousness to label him mentally ill and dangerous. The legal concepts of mentally ill and dangerous versus mentally ill and civilly committed commitment primarily differentiate based on the nature and the degree of the threat posed by the individual to themselves or to others, and the legal procedures involved in their commitment. Mentally ill and dangerous generally refers to the individuals with whose mental illness or substance dependence represents or presents a substantial risk of serious harm, either to themselves or to others. Mentally ill and civilly committed refers and to individuals who are committed to a psychiatric facility through a civil process rather than through the criminal process. The commitment, both commitments generally, I'm sorry, this commitment generally requires proof that the person, due to their mental illness, is a danger to themselves or others, or is unable to meet their basic needs. The commitment for both of these categories requires clear and convincing evidence of the mental illness and the result. The resultant behavior or condition justifying the commitment. Courts have noted that the terms mentally ill and dangerous really lack precise definitions, leading to varied interpretations across various districts. And it leaves a considerable amount of leeway in defining the terms, which affects the determination of which can be civilly or who can be civilly committed. Each of
Counsel,
these, yes.
would you address the issues regarding the three overt acts that were really the basis for the finding that your client engaged in attempt to cause serious physical harm?
My client's argument is twofold, Your Honor. One of the primary concerns is that the court decided, or all of the parties involved in the process, the hospital and the county and the court and the county attorney decided that these actions justified a civil commitment. A person to be justified as civilly committed as mentally ill. There was no evaluation or no consideration or concern by any party that these were behaviors that were considered to be dangerous, which would classify Mr. Folley as mentally ill and dangerous until the alleged action or altercation that occurred between Mr. Folley and Dr. Bauer. That was a tipping point. That was the turning point. And it's my client's argument that the characteristic of the alleged victim is what turned this and not the behaviors. My client, Mr. Folley, is not arguing that he is not he's not arguing that the one of the instances, which includes the stabbing, could not have been something potentially dangerous. He is arguing that the incidences that involve the court, I'm sorry, the hospital staff, including the behavioral nurse and Dr. Bauer, were not incidences that caused a serious harm or could have caused serious harm
So, counsel, with that
in the
argument,
first.
if you are not arguing that particularly the stabbing is not something that could cause substantial harm under the statute, don't we only need one overt act? And if we're indicating that there is the one overt act, that being the stabbing, and that could cause substantial likelihood of harm, do we need to address the other two acts if there is an admission or at least information regarding the one act?
You are correct, Your Honor, that the statutes, that the case law statute only requires one overt act. And it is not my assertion that Mr. Folley is arguing that it does that could not have caused or caused. Well, let me back up. It is Mr. Folley's assertion that there's no evidence that there was a substantial harm. He has not been adjudicated or has not been convicted and has not entered a plea of guilty to those charges. The concern here is that that activity, those allegations occurred before the proceeding on the petition to find Mr. Folley to be mentally ill and dangerous. And that the parties themselves, the court, maybe not the actual judge, but all of the parties involved in this case did not find that behavior to be substantial enough to proceed on a petition until there was an altercation with Dr. Bauer.
So, counsel, is there a time bar for these various instances? And is there any case law regarding? Because my understanding of your argument is that the parties knew about the stabbing in the past. They had not previously filed for Mr. Folley to be mentally ill and dangerous. It's only with these two new instances at the hospital that that happened. Is there any case law regarding this court either disregarding or having a time bar to previous instances or overt acts that may cause a danger to the public?
I do not believe that there is a time bar. What we are raising is a public policy concern. We're not attempting to minimize Mr. Folley's behavior. We're not asking the court to ignore the criminal charges prior to the incidents that involved both the behavioral nurse and the doctor. What we are concerned about is that the court has not, or the lower court did not, look at all of the circumstances. The lower court has a great deal of discretion in these cases, as has been presented in numerous cases. The concern is that that level of discretion was not used appropriately here. As Your Honor noted, that these incidences occurred long before the commitment process for civilly to be committed civil to be civilly committed mentally ill and dangerous. However, at the time of the petition to find Mr. Folley to be committed as mentally ill without the dangerousness piece, these allegations, these charges were all present. And there was no decision, there was no interest in moving forward with the petition for mentally ill and dangerous, despite the fact that these allegations were out there, that these criminal charges were out there, despite the fact that Dr. Bauer was personally aware of the criminal charges that he testified to, despite the fact that Dr. Bauer made notes that he believed that Mr. Foley was becoming more dangerous at the time of his commitment as mentally ill, there was no discussion about dangerousness. And it is my client's argument that the only reason why it moved from civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous is because of the characteristics of the alleged victim in this case, or in that case.
Counsel, outside of the fact that there was an overt act and there were findings regarding the seriousness, what other factors are you indicating that the court either neglected or did not discuss in its order that this court should find that they erred in any way?
And looking at all of the facts, Your Honor, when we're considering that both mentally ill, or both the petition or finding of mentally ill and the need to be civilly committed, as well as the finding of being found mentally ill and dangerous, there's both some level of dangerousness. But that transition from a less serious as far as outcome, less serious as far as restriction and freedom, that there should be a look at all of the circumstances. And it is Mr. Fai's argument that there are a couple of things that the court did not give proper weight to. One of those things is Mr. Fale's treatment at the St. Cloud Hospital, St. Cloud Hospital, which included his exposure to discriminatory animus and racially verbal attacks, the lack of proper dental care. This was a situation that Mr. Fale found himself in: pain, discrimination, verbal attacks, and also the breakdown between the patient-client relationship between Mr. Fale and Dr. Bauer. All of those things were co-occurring at the time of the altercation between Dr. Bauer and Mr. Fale. And even during that time frame, Miss Denise Fale, who is Mr. Fale's guardian, asked for Dr. Bauer to be removed from his care because there was this constant stress. Right after, at that point, Dr. Bauer said he wasn't going to. I'm not going to remove myself. That has been supported by the trial court documentation. And right after that request was when the altercation occurred between Mr. Fale and Dr. Bauer. And Dr. Bauer still, after that, would refuse to remove himself from Mr. Fale's care. Almost in an attempt, my client believes, to continue to have this aggravated relationship. Those were concerns that were brought up to the court, and those are concerns that should have been addressed by the court. Those are issues that led up to the altercation with Dr. Bauer, and Mr. Foley. And these facts should have been taken into consideration when making its determination of mentally ill and dangerous. In addition to that, the court looked at or used Mr. Foley's non-compliance with medication as evidence to show that there will be some future acts of harm, which is required in order to make a finding of mentally ill and dangerous. And the court relied on testimony regarding this history of being non-compliant. And there's a couple of pieces to that that the court either did not address or did not give proper weight. First, that Mr. Fale has an addiction. He was not non-compliant as a willful act, but he has an addiction, and that was an addiction to methamphetamine. And so, in taking those drugs, he stopped taking sometimes his medication for his mental illness. The court also did not address the fact that even when the periods of non-compliance occurred, there had been no attempt to place Mr. Foley on the long-acting injectable neuroleptic medications. According to testimony provided to the court, those long-acting injectables served a couple of purposes, not only to treat the individual with the mental health issues, but also it helps with compliance. There was no history of Mr. Foley refusing to take these long-acting injectables. In fact, they had not yet been tried. But the court used this non-compliance as its basis for determining that Mr. Foley would in the future commit similar acts. The court indicated or relied on one piece of testimony that said that there is no guarantee, but there are no guarantees, no more than there is a guarantee that past behavior will guarantee or predict future behavior. And so we were arguing that there was much less weight given on the fact that the long-acting injectables do actually increase compliance, and more weight given to just one statement that there are no guarantees.
Counsel, I do see that your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Yana.
Counsel, you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you. William Faber, Assistant Benton County Attorney, appearing for respondent. May it please the court. Your Honors, the facts as presented at the trial on January 16th through and the 19th of 2024 clearly and unequivocally support the trial court's findings that Mr. Foley is mentally ill and dangerous. There's the evidence established that appellant is mentally ill. There's no question with regard to that issue. The evidence also clearly establishes appellant committed at least three overt acts since 2022 that qualify as overt acts and support the finding under Minnesota statutes and case law. It's the stabbing that was already mentioned by this court and by Mr. Foley's counsel. The evidence also showed that appellant assaulted a nurse at the behavioral health unit at the St. Cloud Hospital in June of 2023. The evidence also established appellant assaulted Dr. Bauer in June of 2023. Now, all three of these events clearly meet the requirements of an overt act under Minnesota law. And appellant's arguments that the attack on Dr. Bauer was volitional, that the stabbing was due to appellant's perception he needed to protect a girl from trafficking, that the injuries sustained by the victims of these overt acts were not that serious, are all irrelevant to the issues before the trial court under Minnesota law.
Counsel, yeah. I do have a question. As it relates to Dr. Bowers, it seems to me that the appellant's argument is that Dr. Bauer is not credible given his past interaction with Mr. Foley. How should this court address the issue of Dr. Bauer's credibility given the lack of findings in the order regarding credibility findings? So I reviewed the order. I didn't see any credibility findings as it relates to Dr. Bauer. How should this court address that?
Well, Your Honor, Dr. Bauer, of all the doctors who testified, Dr. Bauer is the most credible of all the doctors. He treated him for the longest time. He's been a psychiatrist for 30 years. He's treated Mr. Foley since 2015. He was in the best position to testify regarding not only Mr. Foley's mental illness, but his descent into dangerousness. Now, this is a situation, as the evidence showed at court, that Mr. Foley, in 2015, when he was first civilly committed, he was not dangerous. That dangerousness was not seen. As time has progressed, as his mental illness has progressed, as Dr. Bauer has continued to treat him, that dangerousness has been coming forward and continues to come forward. And that, I think that, under the circumstances in this case, I think that's why the judge found Dr. Bauer's testimony to be incredibly credible because he
But
was the one.
counsel, my question is that we don't know if the judge found Dr. Bowers credible because there is no finding specifically in the order that Dr. Bauer is credible. The order goes through and lists a number of findings of facts of what Dr. Bauer testified to, and this court perhaps can assume that he found Dr. Bauer credible, but given the lack of an explicit finding of credibility on any of the witnesses, and given the argument that appellant is making, I guess the question is, and it sounds like you answered it, how do we look at that given the lack of findings of credibility regarding any of the witnesses?
Well, and I think if you look at the totality of the evidence in this case, it's not just Dr. Bauer that testified that Mr. Foley's mentally ill. All of the doctors testified that Mr. Foley's mentally ill. It's not just Dr. Bauer that testified that Mr. Foley's dangerous. So did Dr. Godding, who's the first examiner. He also testified. So there's corroboration amongst the witnesses to the same information. And the court not finding credibility, I understand that is an issue and that is a concern. But when you look at the totality of the evidence that was presented, and the fact that it's not just Dr. Bauer testifying to things. It's Dr. Bauer, it's Dr. Godding, it's Dr. Bachman. Even Dr. Ahlberg, Mr. Foley's expert, testified with regard to the fact that he is mentally ill. The fact that the injectable medication does not guarantee compliance. That we have a history of noncompliance. Those types of things. All of the evidence that was presented was corroborated by all the doctors that testified. So the fact that one doctor was not found to be credible, the other doctors all testified to the same thing, which gives that evidence credibility. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Now,
counsel, would you address the argument we heard from appellant's counsel with regard to the medical, well, let's put it this way, that the shift seemed to come with the deterioration into viewing Mr. Foley as dangerous? Because they're not disputing mental illness. So to try to focus the expert, your analysis of the record on the dangerousness requirement, that really came with the shift or deterioration in Mr. Foley's relationship with Dr. Bauer.
Well, it really didn't come from that. That was obviously a linchpin, so to speak. But if you look back at the history, honestly, Benton County was considering filing for dangerousness, mentally ill and dangerous before those assaults occurred based on Mr. Foley's history. This was a decision that was made not only by Benton County. Stearns County was also involved because substantial contact with Mr. Foley. So the fact that Dr. Bauer was attacked was a linchpin, but it wasn't the only consideration. It was the fact that we had, as indicated in the multiple criminal complaints that were brought forward as part of the evidence in this case, that there has to be a circumstance that essentially puts you over the top. All right. The consideration of mentally ill and dangerous had been discussed before those attacks at the hospital occurred. But once you add those two assaults at the hospital on top of Mr. Foley's history of noncompliance, of criminal acts, of dangerous activities, that's why we filed. But it wasn't just because of Dr. Bauer's attack. That was just one of multiple considerations. Now, I know I only have a short time left, but I'd like to address appellant's last two arguments. The dangerousness, I think, is pretty clear where we're coming from. My brief does address that, but I do want to briefly address the two arguments with regard to the least restrictive means of treatment. That was not an issue before the trial court, and it's still not an issue before the trial court. essentially, the appeal on that issue is premature. As stated within the statute, you have to look at least restrictive alternative for treatment, but only after a person's been indeterminately committed. That hasn't happened yet. At this point, Mr. Folley's been found mentally ill and dangerous. We're waiting for him to get to St. Peter for the statutory 60-day evaluation period. It's after that 60-day evaluation period, when it comes back to court, where it's determined how long the commitment is. If it's an indeterminate commitment, then at that point, the trial court has to look at the least restrictive alternative for treatment. That issue was not before the trial court, so it was not an error that the court didn't find the least restrictive alternative. The only issue before the trial court was whether he was mentally ill and dangerous. And with regard to the procedural errors, as stated in my brief, the hearsay evidence that was allowed by the trial court had to do with Mr. Folley's multiple oral threats to kill Dr. Bauer along with staff at the hospital. The court found that to be reliable hearsay. The court found that during the trial, it was reliable hearsay. The statute and case law states that hearsay evidence and commitment matters is allowable if the court finds it to be reliable. And the court found that in this case. So the issues that were brought in through that hearsay evidence, what had to go directly to those oral threats, which is something the court has to consider when determining whether a person is dangerous. It's acts, past acts, and oral threats are all have to be considered by the court to make a determination with regard to dangerousness. So the court allowed that as reliable hearsay. There was no violation at this on that issue. With regard to the conflict of interest argument that was made, quite honestly, that argument, I don't know where it came from. It was never brought up at the trial court. The argument is that Judge Jesse, who handled the MIND trial, also handled the criminal matters that Mr. Folley was charged with here. He doesn't. Judge Raup is handling those cases in Benton County. So there's no perceived there's no perceived bias. There's certainly no actual bias that was shown by either the facts or any legal support. And appellant's argument doesn't have any legal support for those arguments. So under those two issues, I would ask the court simply to affirm the trial court with regard to those two issues. Now, with regard to dangerousness, for my last 4 minutes here.
So, counsel, if I could, I hate to interrupt
you, absolutely. But
I'm curious about how you reason through. Of course, we've got the district court's finding a substantial likelihood that Mr. Folley would engage in additional acts. And to some extent, that is based on this long history of noncompliance with medication. And the argument I heard appellant's counsel make is that the district court didn't consider the evidence with regard to long-lasting injectable treatment. Now, you suggest otherwise, and I'm just, if you to elaborate on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I think the fact that the evidence of the long-acting injectable medications coming in, they are helping. I don't think there's any doubt that they agree they are helping Mr. Folley, but there still is no guarantee of compliance, and that's what you have to look at. And the testimony, and the court did note in the order that it doesn't guarantee compliance, and his long history of noncompliance, I think, is a key to the finding of dangerousness here. I mean, we have a person who has, no matter what medication he's been on, he has come to the hospital unmedicated, acting on his delusions and paranoid. He gets treated. He stabilizes. He's released from the secure hospital. He almost immediately takes himself off the medications, starts using street drugs, becomes delusional again, starts acting as paranoia again, and he's back at the hospital. That long-acting injectable medication is no guarantee that history is going to change. And that history doesn't include one or two hospitalizations. It includes...
Counsel, can I interrupt for a minute? I'm trying to understand the ramifications of the long-acting injectable medications. you're suggesting that he won't be compliant even with those injections, but aren't those injections to avoid noncompliance? Isn't that the point of those?
That's the idea, Judge. But the problem we have, even his treating physician, Dr. Bachman, testified that he has serious concerns that once Mr. Fahlay leaves the hospital, he won't come in. He will have to go to a clinic to get those injections. And he has serious concerns that he's just simply not going to do that based on his history.
Would you walk me through that for a minute? How long did they last? Do you know, the record shows?
Well, typically, I believe the injections are every 2 weeks. I believe that's what it is.
Okay.
So once he's, and right now he's at the Benton County Jail and he is getting his medications, although he is not happy about it, but he is getting his medications because the Jarvis order is still in place. Right. But once he leaves, he's going to have to go to a clinic, get the injection every 2 weeks. And Dr. Bachman's testimony was he had serious concerns whether he was going to be willing to do that based on the fact that he doesn't believe he's mentally ill. He doesn't believe he needs medications, and he doesn't believe he needs to be hospitalized, and he continues to act on his, endorse his delusional beliefs. So that's where Dr. Bachman's concern is. And appellant seems to argue that, or wants the court to believe that this long-acting injectable medication is a guarantee, and it's not. And Ms. Sullivan's correct. There are no guarantees. But the way the rules are set up, the judge has to make, based on the evidence that's presented, the judge has to make a determination whether the judge believes, based on the history, that that history is going to continue. And that's exactly what Judge Jesse did in this case. Is he did consider the fact, and the evidence was in with regard to the long-acting injectables, but the evidence also showed that there's no guarantees, and his treating physician is still concerned that he's not going to take his meds. So I see my time is up. I thank the court for the time to argue this. If you have any other questions, certainly I can answer those.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Sullivan, you can begin your rebuttal when you are ready.
Thank you. There were no credibility findings as to Dr. Bauer. The issue, the concern with hearsay is that even though Dr. Bauer made broad sweeping statements about Mr. Fahlay's aggressiveness and him being the most aggressive person he's ever seen, I mean, these were statements that were made about Mr. Fahlay's behavior. But even the behavioral nurse contradicted by saying that his behavior was very common in that unit. Dr. Bauer was allowed to testify about what the behavioral nurse not only said, but what she felt. And that was improper hearsay, especially because we have evidence in the file indicating that her statement about Mr. Fahlay's behavior contradicted directly what Dr. Bauer stated Mr. Fahlay's behavior was. The concern, I can respect the statements of opposing counsel that they were going to eventually, and they were thinking about this dangerousness petition. But in fact, with all of the information that the county had, all of the charges, all of the allegations were sitting before it, and it still decided to petition for mentally ill and to civilly commit Mr. Fahlay. Not to commit him as civil, as mentally ill and dangerous. So there was in fact an opportunity to do so. But an evaluation of all of the information that was before it, excluding the incidences with the behavioral nurse and Dr. Bauer, absent those things, there was still a decision and the court granted this order to find Mr. Fahlay mentally ill and civilly committed. The injections that were referenced are available on every 2 weeks or a monthly basis. And that is very different than taking a daily pill. That is something that lasts for a minimum of 2 weeks and a maximum of 1 month that had not yet been pursued, despite Mrs. Fahlay's request of Dr. Bauer that be tried. We are not arguing that Mr. Fahlay should be released and have no consequences for his actions. What our concern is that the lower court's decision was not based on a proper assessment of the facts, a proper assessment of the hearsay, of hearsay testimony, and a proper assessment of all of the issues and facts that led up to this petition to determine Mr. Foley to be mentally ill and dangerous.
Counsel,
the
can
court
I can I have just
yes
for a minute?
Sure.
The you mentioned more about the injectables and the length that they are effective. The interplay with the use of meth, though, would negate any benefit, I would guess, I'm guessing, from the injected psychoactive drugs. And that's an undressed addiction, am I correct?
There was nothing in the lower court's decision to address the possible concurrent consumption of the two. What I was trying to point out is that with the injections, you can't not comply. I mean, we have to kind of think about maybe in the future what might happen if you had the injectables and then on top of the injectables used meth. That's something that was not assessed at the lower court. But the concern has been that he stopped using medication in order to use meth. In this case, if he's on it for 2 weeks or an entire month, we don't have an assessment of what would happen there. We have to kind of predict if he gets a medication today and he uses tomorrow, what would happen? Would that cause him to be not compliant? Well, not compliant with meds because he already has a medication in his system. He may be violating his plan in trying to become drug free. But as far as medication compliance is concerned, he wouldn't have any options of being compliant, at least for a minimum of a 2 week to a 1 month window. And in fact, opposing counsel mentioned that Mr. Foley is on long acting injectable. Well, he was. He doesn't get a choice really when he's in custody. He's been taking off that medication for whatever reason, and not to his own request. Here, in closing, I think the issue is that the lower court, as I mentioned, just did not properly assess all of the circumstances in this case. His needs, his treatment at St. Cloud Hospital, the impact of the long-acting injectables, and the fact that they had not been tried with Mr. Foley and could substantially reduce the risk of non-compliance. And I would state that the court did make a finding about a least restrictive means. Whether they were supposed to or not, or whether it's premature, the court made a finding. The court made a finding in its order without giving an analysis of this less restrictive means. The court simply took one of the statements of one of the parties and said, St. Peter is the least restrictive means. So the court did, in fact, make a decision.
Counsel, I do see that your time has expired. Thank you both for your arguments. This matter has been submitted, and the court will issue an order within the statutory timeline. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.